TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, how are you feeling today? Did you get your full 17 minutes of sleep in the last rotation?
Well, Chris, I actually only got 14 minutes.
Oh, man. I hate it.
So, not
happens.
As much as I'm used to.
Yeah.
So, I apologize to anyone on this episode. I just may be a little bit cranky, and I'm sorry about that. But, you know, it's the full 17 minutes is just so important.
Well, I'll tell you, I might be a little groggy today because I slept 19 minutes. And when I oversleep like a little bit too much, sometimes just it's hard for me to get into gear. It just throws off my biological clock.
100% understand, Chris. So hopefully people can just roll with us today. You know, forgive the yawns that may appear. It's going to happen, you know, but we are just going to, you know, bear with it and work through it. So thanks everybody for sticking with us. We appreciate it. And I know this one might be just a little bit tough.
We'll try our best. We'll try our best, right?
But you know what, Chris? I feel like I'm living the greatest adventure doing this podcast with you. So it's pretty exciting.
You are. And if you feel tired and you need to shroud for a few minutes, I'll carry on. Don't worry.
I appreciate that. I 100% appreciate that. So that's so good of you.
Yes, everyone. We're going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine today as we discuss the fifth episode of Season 1, Captive Pursuit. And here's a very quick rundown of the episode. The arrival of an alien from the Gamma Quadrant puts Chief O'Brien at the center of first contact when TOSK, as the reptilian calls itself, requires ship repair. As the mystery of TOSK unfolds and alien hunters arrive seeking to take O'Brien's new friend back to be publicly humiliated, the chief finds himself questioning the Starfleet rule of non-interference. So, Matthew, let's just start with the arrival of TOSK. Since we don't yet know where Odo is from, TOSK represents the first alien to come through the wormhole from the Gamma Quadrant to the station, and it creates a great moment for us to get to know another culture, have some cultural exchange, and of course, some misunderstandings as well.
Yeah, I think this is one of the beauties of this show, and it's something that I'm sure that the writers thought long and hard about when you were thinking about, okay, so we're going to do a show on a space station. How do we make this interesting when, you know, legitimately, we're not going anywhere every week. You know, that's the thing that is always said about this series. It doesn't go anywhere. And so I think that what makes this beautiful then is that they thought, I think, very long and hard about, okay, how do we make a show that is interesting when our characters are not traveling out? Well, you know, if you think about that, you are doing the Western town, so the train comes to you, and it brings new people every single week. And so I think that's the thing that's really cool about this, is that by putting this next to the wormhole, it is basically the train station of the Alpha Quadrant right now. And, you know, people are going to be coming and going, and therefore you have the ability to have all of these interesting characters and things happening throughout the series without actually having to go anywhere. And you know, this is a first, like you said, of us having this new race, which I think is the very first challenge of this show to the ideals of the Federation and the Alpha mm-hmm. Quadrant. And so I really appreciate this episode for that. And I think it's something that always helps me enjoy this episode again and again, and makes it really rewatchable, because in a lot of ways, this is an episode that I think really shines a light on how difficult it is to really truly accept other cultures as they are without judging them. And so this first visitor allows us to do that. But yeah, it's a lot of fun to get this other culture. And then, of course, they have the hard choice of, having to create new cultures mm-hmm. over and over again here for us to be able to enjoy, which
you mean the writers having to create, not the
yes, crew, yes, course, the writers having to do that, which again, that's not something that I envy them at all for, because it's not easy to come up with a new race every week mm-hmm. and to make them interesting enough that we might want to revisit them. So,
well, revisiting them is the thing, right? Because on The Next Generation, we did get new races, and on Voyager, they're constantly having to run into new races because of the nature of the show. They're traveling across the Delta Quadrant. And so you got into that alien of the week idea on Voyager, mm-hmm. but rarely did they need to revisit those aliens. Only a few of them, like the Hirogen, for example. But here, kind of anyone that we're introduced to has the potential of resurfacing because of the stationary nature of the show, right? And this is something I wasn't going to bring up today because we're doing a rewatch and we try not to talk ahead too much. But there is an interesting point about Tosk and this episode and what you're talking about with the idea of creating new aliens and would we see them again or not. And it's the idea that Tosk and the Jem'Hadar have these similarities, not only in the fact that they're both kind of reptilian, but they can both shroud. And when the Jem'Hadar were conceived, it was actually stated for the writers that the shrouding effect should be the same as what Tosk had. And then there was this idea also stated that, not stated on screen, I don't think, but in concept, that the same people who created the Tosk for being hunted also engineered the Jem'Hadar. And I find that really interesting in if they had carried through with that on the screen because of the fact of the Jem'Hadar's relationship to the Dominion. And then if you think about these hunters, we know in this episode that the hunters who arrive on the station, they engineered the Tosk and they gave the Tosk sentience. And so thinking about the overall Deep Space Nine story, the idea that the aliens that we saw in this episode as the hunters could be the same people who created the Jem'Hadar, I think is just really kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I love that idea. It's not something that I personally had even thought of until you brought it up. And I think one of the things that makes that really interesting to me is the idea that, you know, they come from the Gamma Quadrant. And so the fact that you would have the Dominion basically stealing ideas from people that they are most likely dominant of.
Mm-hmm. Or forcing those people to create warriors for them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly. Is awesome. I think it makes so much sense that would be the case. And so I really appreciate, again, to me, this is one of those things where I just feel like the writers are doing a really good job of thinking through mm-hmm. the ramifications later on of, you know, the characters that they have created for the show. It's one of those places where, again, obviously this was not in their mind when we actually are creating this episode.
Right.
But it is something that is a seed that they just use later on. And they continually do this over and over again, which I find so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Me too. And now going back to the idea of this being the town, the stationary nature of the show, you mentioned, you know, people arriving in the town. It really struck me this time rewatching, and I've watched this episode, I don't know how many times, but this time it really struck me that when the three alien hunters transport themselves onto the station, and then Sisko and Kira and Odo, they're all coming down the corridor as well. That corridor felt like the dusty road in the middle of the Wild West town. And then you've got like these three bandits arriving in the town, and yep. You've got the sheriff and the deputies, and you've got this standoff. And it was very striking how much that feeling is captured in that scene, even though it's set in science fiction, and to the extent that these hunters are wearing these helmets and right. spacesuits that feel almost more like Star Wars than Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think this is just one more example of the writers really following through on the promise of the show and the premise that they had, and really making good on that. And it goes to show that this idea, I think, was rife with possibilities if done well. Mm-hmm. And to me, this proves that you don't have to be going somewhere for things to be interesting here in Star Trek. And it's interesting because it's obviously something that a lot of people complain about. But I think they really do a great job here of helping us to understand that, yeah, you can create good stories. In all honesty, just might mean you have to work a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm. So this story, we've been talking the past few episodes about whether the story would be at home on the Next Generation. And this one, I can imagine you doing this on the Enterprise, but this is a point where I do feel like they're really differentiating the tone of the show more mm-hmm. from the Next Generation, because I can imagine the Enterprise D encountering Tosk's ship and bringing him on board. It's a
right.
bit harder to imagine, although it could certainly happen, the three alien hunters just transporting themselves onto the Enterprise and everything else playing out, you know, the yeah. way it does in this story. But I think also more importantly, the whole thing, which we'll talk about in more detail, of how O'Brien handles the situation, how he comes to make the decision to do what he does, and then the way that Sisko deals with it. Kind of all of this is set into motion by the fact that they're aboard this station and it's not a Starfleet facility per se, and they're
right.
dealing with
right.
people on the staff who aren't indoctrinated into that Starfleet prime directive mentality.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent point. You know, that there is putting this on a station to which is a joint venture for Starfleet with the Bajorans opens up a whole new world of possibilities, like you said, in a way that I don't even know if the writers were really cognizant of until maybe later on in the series. But I think they knew immediately, though, this was going to give them the opportunity to introduce conflict that didn't conflict with Gene Roddenberry's idea of Star Trek and Federation officers at this time period and the idea of conflict, which in many ways I think is what makes this such genius. And 100%, I believe it has to do with the fact that, yeah, we're here in this place that we're going to bring conflict to you. We've introduced conflict because we don't just have Starfleet officers on this station. And we're also just introducing races coming in and out of the show frequently, which, you know, is great. So I absolutely love this. It's just, it's one of my favorite things. And I don't know if I think years ago would have said like, oh man, yeah, Captive Pursuit, I love that episode. But it, I think it's also one that's just kind of grown on me even more over time, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah. I always really liked this episode, I think because the idea of the story is very interesting. Of course, it's inspired by, I guess would be the best word, inspired by a short story by Richard Connell called The Most Dangerous Game, about hunting. It's a very old story from 1924. And the story does, I think, very well what Star Trek did in the original series and on The Next Generation, which is to take an issue that is controversial in our own society and then address that through science fiction and by putting our characters into a situation that's a parallel, but of course we can talk about it in a different way. And so in that short story, of course, there is a man who's being hunted. So it raises the idea of, should you be hunting people? But of course, a big controversy in our own world is even, should you be hunting animals? And and if someone's sentient, of course, this is what Sisko says to the hunter in the story, is that centuries ago on Earth, people engaged in blood sports, killing lower species for pleasure, and a few cultures still do. I found that interesting too, because if you read that the way it sounds like it's intended, it means that on Earth in the 24th century, there are still some cultures that are engaged in blood sport. Now, he may mean other cultures in the Federation, but it's maybe not completely clear. But anyway, he goes on to say, even they wouldn't consider hunting a sentient being. And so there, we're once again addressing this theme that has been retold a number of times based on that short story, but doing it within the context of science fiction. And they made one, I said I always found this episode very interesting. I think that they made Tosk a very likable character, a character who you could really sympathize with. And then on top of that, I feel that Scott McDonald, the actor who plays Tosk, does a really good job of portraying that alien, even through movements. Just, he really captures the feel of Tosk. And then there's all the character growth for O'Brien as well. And the fact that, again, we don't get that clean-cut solution like we would probably get on The Next Generation. And so for all those reasons, it's always been among my favorite episodes from season one.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that, as you were talking, the beauty of this episode is, and we've said this multiple times, and I think it's going to be something that we continue to say, because it is something to which this show seems to be doing specifically over and over again, which is that it is differentiating itself from TNG almost every single week. And I think the thing that you just said that helps this differentiate itself is that this doesn't have the same type of solution that you would have if you were watching TNG. I think TNG, Picard would have, of course, moralized to them and maybe changed their minds about this type of hunting. Right. And everybody would have like learned a lesson and then gone home. And, you know, that doesn't happen here. And I think that's something that makes this a better episode because of it. And in many ways, I think that really comes down to the crux of the issue with this episode. And it makes it one that's very difficult, which is, this one is challenging the Federation's idea of the fact of infinite diversity and infinite combinations, something that they took from the Vulcans and that they really truly respect all other societies and other cultures. Because, you know, Sisko's first thing here is to judge them. and to see them as lesser because of their attitude towards Tosk and what they're doing. So I find that really fascinating, because I think it's definitely a human thing, which is to say that there are things to which we would not accept. Mm-hmm. We would say are wrong in all circumstances, regardless of what race or culture you come from, right? And this is one of those shows which I think really does a great job of showing just how difficult it is to say that we would just accept every culture and whatever it is that they say is right, because, you know, what is right in their own eyes. Like, we can't do that as human beings. We have this intrinsic feeling of right and wrong, and therefore we find that to be kind of impossible to actually do. And so this, I love that this episode, I think, shines a very clear light on that.
Well, what you say there shows the intricate nature of what Sisko's going through in this episode, I would say, because, like you say, he does judge them from his own perspective. He absolutely thinks what they're doing is wrong. But when he's talking to the hunter, he does say, I can't judge what is right and wrong for your world.
Right.
And then he says, but on this station, of course, he's going to control it. But
right.
But the thing is that Sisko acknowledges that even though he does not agree with what they're doing, it's not his place to pass judgment on the other culture and interfere with them. And so he decides that he will let them go. But as the story plays out, and as he's receiving input from others, he's really rethinking things. You know, we don't necessarily see all of that happening, but when we get to the end, it's very clear that he has rethought things. And while he's not going to step in as a Starfleet commander and say to O'Brien, yes, it's okay for you to help Tosk escape, he's also going to let it happen. And I think the final scene with Sisko and O'Brien really illustrates all of that very well, because O'Brien does get dressed down by Sisko forcefully, as Sisko must do as his commander. But then when O'Brien asks him, you know, I was surprised. I knew I couldn't override all the security seals on the station, and I figured that once you figured it out, it'd be over and we'd be locked up. And then Sisko just says, I guess that one got by us. And then O'Brien says, yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
And but you can tell O'Brien also realizes, and O'Brien is the perfect character to do this with, because he served on the Enterprise under Picard for so long. And the Picard wouldn't have done that the way that Sisko did. Especially not the Picard during that run of The Next Generation. Like, older Picard maybe might be a little bit more willing to bend the rules like that. But the Picard that O'Brien served under would have been far more strict. And this is that moment of realization that Sisko is different. And, you know, they couldn't have done it with any other character on the main cast and had it work like this.
I think the thing that I really appreciate about this episode, too, is that, you know, like you said, Sisko says, you know, I can't judge you. Except in that statement is full of judgment.
Right.
Yeah. Which is what I kind of, again, it I think that the intricacy of this episode is showing how, and this is one of the first episodes where we are truly kind of butting up against the ideals of the Federation, and how far will those bend in light of meeting new races and new civilizations and all of that, which to me, I find fascinating, because I think there is a limit. And Sisko recognizes that limit. He can't officially do anything about it. But like you said, here, there's this beautiful thing where, you know, O'Brien takes it on himself and Sisko realizes what's happening. And then he's not going to, quote unquote, lift too many fingers to make things happen, right? Like to make sure he gets stopped. But the other thing I love about this is that conversation between Quark and O'Brien, where Quark helps O'Brien realize this is a game to them. What are the rules of that game? And really, there aren't a lot of rules to that game. The only rule is that Tosk, you know, one of the only rules is that Tosk shouldn't get caught. Mm-hmm. And so by then changing the rules here.
Or shouldn't get caught alive.
Right.
Yeah.
By changing the by playing even within the rules, we're able to give them what they want, which I think is really cool. And in some ways, it's kind of a very Kirk thing to do, which is, okay, what are the rules of this game? And then should I and can I change the rules of that game? And I think that's a, you know, that's
I don't
what,
like to lose.
Exactly. This felt very, to me, reminiscent of a Kirk solution to a problem. Yeah. Which really made this fun.
Yeah, yeah. I had exactly the same thought. Like, that's what Kirk would do, right? But I love that conversation with Quark because it is Quark. They set it up really well, I think, in this episode because O'Brien keeps calling Quark barkeep, which Quark hates. And by setting it up with this sort of, like, there's this wall that O'Brien puts between himself and Quark. And he doesn't respect Quark, and yet in the conversation, it's Quark who actually flips the switch on for O'Brien and makes him realize that there is another solution. Just change the rules. Yep. And something else I was thinking about that's interesting is that when we go into Quark's, which I love that O'Brien refers to it as the flea market of the sector, the promenade, I guess he's more talking about. But when they go in, not just in this episode, but in general, we walk into Quark's and people are always playing Dabo. You've got the sounds, people are excited, and it's Dabo, and you've got this game going. And in this episode, because O'Brien says it's just the rules of the game, and Quark says, aha, rules of the game. Go on. You know, well, rules are always subject to interpretation, and all of this is about a game. I feel like by having this Dabo game in Quark's in the first place, it allows the writers to play off of the idea that so much of what we feel and see and think about life is subject to rules.
Right.
That are associated with a game, and you hear people say sometimes, you know, life is a game, and it's like this subliminal, this background noise that's going on in the episodes where you literally have a game going on in situations where Quark, as a bartender, as a barkeep, as O'Brien calls him, just like Guinan was on The Next Generation, dispenses advice and helps people look at things from different perspectives and find solutions and find different paths.
Yeah, I love that you bring that up because it's one of the things that you made me think about how the beginning of the episode starts with the Dabo girl who's come to Cisco about the sexual misconduct of Quark. Mm-hmm. And then we find out that that's written into her contract.
And isn't it interesting, though, in this episode, I'm just contrasting how a story would be written today and how it was written 30 years ago. Isn't it interesting how they don't say it on the screen? Like, the sentences keep trailing off. Like, you know what they're talking about, but they don't explicitly say what's written into the contract.
Right.
Yeah. I just thought that was interesting.
I think what makes that great is that it's setting up the thematic element of judging other cultures because this is clearly something that is normal on Ferenginar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we'll learn that later on in the series, actually, as well, from Quark. I think in a conversation with either Jadzia or someone else. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this episode is doing such a great job of pushing our buttons for what are the boundaries that we would accept other cultures on their own basis before we would be like, you know what? No, I don't care what culture you're from. That's wrong. Mm-hmm. And this episode is doing that. It does it at the very beginning, and then the rest of the episode plays out that entire theme as well. And it's done in a way to which allows the characters to get away with not approving of a certain culture, but then by playing by their own rules, allowing a character that we've come to care about go on and live their life, you know. And so I just, the nuance alone in this episode of what we're doing and what we're talking about is so well done, and it doesn't tell you what to think. Mm-hmm. Because it leaves it ambiguous, because Tosk, our main character, to which we're seeing that through his eyes with this, that's his life and that's what he wants.
Right. That's a key point, right? And that's what's very interesting too, because it is presented from really three perspectives. I suppose four, but there's Sisko at the very beginning judging, there's no way you should be hunting a sentient being. That's crazy. And then there's O'Brien, who's faced with respecting the prime directive, not getting involved, or righting something that he perceives as a wrong.
Right.
Then there's Tosk, who doesn't even see it as a wrong, who, like you just said, sees it as the reason for his very existence. And mm-hmm. But that and O'Brien's desire to help him escape fits together well, because what Tosk most wants is to be able to continue the chase, to mm-hmm. not be captured, right. Because his purpose in life, as he sees it, isn't simply to act as prey, and if I get caught, I get caught. If I don't, I don't. He's supposed to right. make the hunt as exciting as possible and to keep it going. And then there are four. There are the hunters who feel that once captured, you know, this has ended. It's okay to hunt the sentient species because they created them in the first place,
right.
which is a whole other question that isn't explored here, but could be in another episode, is if you create something, do you then have the right to control it and determine its path in life, right? So there are all these questions raised in this episode, and there's no definitive answer given, right?
And we don't know this yet, but that's actually going to be one of the biggest questions of the entire series, because mm-hmm. Sisko was created by the
good
prophets.
Point. Yeah.
And therefore, really the theme of this episode is actually going to be explored extensively through our main character, Sisko mm-hmm. himself. And so I think, because that is a huge question, like, because, and what it is one of the most metaphysical questions there are, which is, okay, so if we were created by a godlike being or a god, right, don't they have the right, because they're God, to decide what and who and if and where and when and all of those things? So it is an incredibly important question. And again, it's one we play out for the rest of the series through our main character.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And I think a lot of people would feel that if they're created by God, then whatever God wants for their life is the path they should just follow.
Exactly. And,
but there are other people who I think might question that. It gets into this whole debate about free will, for example, but might question
right, exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in questioning that, does that necessarily conflict with faith in the first place, which I would personally think it doesn't necessarily have to conflict with faith, but it's an interesting question. And I hadn't thought about the fact that this does set up the whole Cisco question. That's a really good observation.
Well, and I think that the coolness of this whole thing is that you will play out this idea of faith and predestination, you know, because there's this whole timey-wimey thing of the way they do it all, where Cisco meeting the prophets, it's what leads them to go back in time because they're out of time to create them in the first place. And it's just, you know, so it's such a... I think this is the beauty of Deep Space Nine, right? We're watching an episode in the first season that seems on, I would say, the facade to be somewhat silly, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, as you plumb the depths of it, you realize, wow, not only is this not silly, but they are actually beginning to ask some of the biggest questions that we ask as human beings. And then... the beauty of that is that they actually take this question and they run with it with the rest of the series. And that's the greatness of this show. And it's why we love it so much, because it's led to so many years of incredible conversations that are not just about, oh, wasn't that a cool spaceship battle? But it's really about the human adventure. You know, Tosk says that he's living the greatest adventure. Mm-hmm. And Deep Space Nine is about plumbing the depths of the human adventure.
Yep, exactly. And they do this and give us this new story and this deep story while reusing ships and props and all from past episodes in this episode where, you know, there's Tosk's ship itself is one that they've reused a number of times. Most memorable for me is A Matter of Time when Max Headroom comes back and it's his ship, Rasmussen's ship. But I just bring that up just to say that it shows how Star Trek, without having to reinvent everything every single time, can give us stories like this through the imagination of the writers while reusing props and sets and materials and such that they've used before. So it's really, it's the storytelling, right? It's not, you know, you mentioned, wasn't that a great space battle, for example, rather than doing what is so often done in these days in television because it's easier to make visual effects and all, instead of making it all about that, it's like, okay, let's use what we have, let's redress it, make it work with the story that we have put together where the story is the focal point. And let's just figure out, you know, how can we actually put this story together on the screen instead of focusing on the action and the visuals and all that as much.
Well, and I think that's the other thing that makes this episode great is that by telling a interesting story, by telling a story that's making us ask and think about all of these questions, I wasn't really even paying attention in the episode to that aspect, right? Because I'm wrapped up in everything else that's happening on the episode. And so I think that's something to which shows exactly what you're saying is you don't have to create everything new all the time. You can do what Star Trek has done for so many years, which is reuse things. But if you do it in an interesting way, I, as the audience member, am not going to care.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, any final thoughts on this? And what's your rating for this one?
Yeah, I loved this episode and rewatching it. I love that this allows us to be able to spend time with O'Brien and really to get a sense of who this character is. You know, and I think the beauty of this episode is we really learn a lot about who O'Brien is in one episode. You know, he's somebody who has incredible empathy. He is that everyman that, you know, could go and do this first contact in a way that he's able to, just through conversation, open up this person from a completely different culture, learn about them, what makes them tick, without ever having to ask super direct questions, mm-hmm. but just being like, well, tell me more about that, you know, those kind of things. Very, very good. I mean, you know, it's the kind of stuff that all of your, you know, if you go to a therapy, they do. Oh, tell me more about that. Mm-hmm. And O'Brien just does it naturally. So I love it. I think this is actually a really great episode. It's actually even better after this conversation. Yeah. And so I'm going to give this 4.5 out of 5 ridiculously large helmets.
Excellent. Yeah, I love those helmets. That's one thing that always stands out to me about this episode, just that I remember, is the fact that it's the time that those aliens that didn't look like usual Star Trek aliens came to the station. Because, I don't know, it's just something about those outfits feels different than what normally get. And I said they feel like Star Wars to me. It wouldn't be the only time that Deep Space Nine gives us a Star Wars look, because we do get the Breen later. And I'm pretty sure that Princess Leia is under there somewhere. Under that helmet. All right. Well, I don't know. I've summed up my feelings about this episode pretty thoroughly here, I would say. And like you said, I think after our conversation and after rewatching it again today, I appreciate the episode even more. And I'm going to give it 8 evasive tasks.
Nice.
Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Captive Pursuit. If you'd like to share those with us, perhaps the best way to do it is to join the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's our closed group just for listeners. It's there to extend the conversation beyond the podcasts. And so it's a great way to share your thoughts, not only with Matthew and me, but with your fellow listeners, and have a conversation. If you're already a member, of course, you know what to do. If you're not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. As I mentioned, it is a closed group, so if you're joining for the first time, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post for this episode there on the timeline, and you can post your comments there. Of course, you can also send us email. Just go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the orb, and that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. So thank you to everyone who has rated us and reviewed us. Well, Matthew, when you're not busy practicing your shrouding skills, where can people find you?
Well, when that's not happening, you can find me all over the social medias under the name MattRushing02. So Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero are all the places I'm most active. You can find me here on the network in a bunch of different places. One is the 602 Club, which is our general geek show for all the other shows that we love, not just Star Trek. There's so much else to talk about, so we hope you'll check that out. Also doing literary tracks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We're doing our 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise on Warp 5. You can also find us doing Saddle Up about Strange New Worlds. And then, Chris, as we're recording this, this is premiere eve for Star Trek Picard Season 3. I'm so excited. I don't even know if I'm going to stay. I'm probably going to stay up late tonight to watch it. But you can catch us on the Artificial Tango, where we're dancing away to Star Trek Picard Season 3. So check that out. And then on the Nerd Party Network, a couple of shows. One's called Owl Post about Harry Potter. And the other is all about Star Wars Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. But Chris, where can people find you?
Well, before I reveal that, I just have to say, you have to stay up because Beverly asks you to, Matthew, and you can't. You cannot go against Beverly's wishes.
It's very true. It's a valid point, Chris.
Yeah, well, when I'm not doing all of those shows with you here on the network, which you mentioned, you can also find me sometimes on The Ready Room, which Larry Nemechek and I do together. That's actually the original discussion podcast here on the network, started back in 2011. And you can also find me on many other episodes and various shows in the back catalog. And if you'd like to chat about Star Trek or Japan or whatever, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Twitter is where I'm most active. I'm also on Mastodon now. If you've moved over there, you can find me, C. Brian Jones, on the Trekkies.social instance, and I'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing in the network going, we could definitely use your help. It takes a great deal of money to produce and distribute these podcasts, and we wouldn't be here without the support of all of our listeners. If you'd like to find out how to get involved, become an associate producer of our rewatches, or get involved in other ways, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We'd like to send a huge thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. It's thanks to you that we're able to share these podcasts with everyone. So thank you very much. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time when we're going to get a visit from Q, but more importantly, from Vash.
Well, Chris, that sounds very exciting. Thankfully, I'm not Picard. So we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.